View Conversations.
And good evening and welcome to this March 6, 2015 edition of Worldview Conversations. As always, it's 7 p.m. on the East Coast. It's 4 p.m. on the left coast, and broadcasting from the People's Republic of California. This is going to be a good show. Our guest this evening is Harold Covington, and he is the spokesperson for the Front. Before we bring him on, I want to make a couple of announcements. As we have announced in prior shows, during the month of February, we made a change. We transitioned from the American Nationalist Association and American Nationalist Network to the All Nationalist Association and the All Nationalist Network. That transition is complete. You're now listening to the All Nationalist Network, a component of the All Nationalist Network. And no, we're not going to be taking any phone calls. But anyway, I think you, as you visit our website and look at our social media pages and look at our Blog Talk Network pages, you'll find that all of our various banners have all now been changed to reflect our transition to the All Nationalist Association and All Nationalist Network. There may be a few stragglers with regard to our show graphics. Those will be changed out fairly soon. And that was done to reflect our international operations and the significant number of international shows, which are expanding. We're going to be adding two more international shows beginning Tuesday at 4 p.m. Eastern. The Northwest Front is Harold's show. We're going to be talking about that. The National Front will be premiering on ANN Radio Tuesday at 4 p.m. Eastern. The National Front will be the radio show for the National Front of the United Kingdom, which is the premier racial nationalist party in the United Kingdom. Now, it will premiere at 4 Eastern Time, broadcasting live from the United Kingdom, and that will be an hour after another United Kingdom-based party, David Jones's Atlantic Axis. Then, coming in April, will be a monthly show that will be entitled The All Nationalist Roundtable. Now, this will be a roundtable show broadcast in the evening that will feature representatives from various nationalist parties, from the National Front to the Party of the Danes to the NPD in Germany. It will probably have about four, maybe five participants from around Europe and the United States representing racial nationalist parties and interests, discussing issues and, you know, just generally bringing representatives of various real racialist parties. We're not talking about parties like Defend Jews and Homosexuals. We're talking about real racial nationalist parties like the National Front in the United Kingdom, real racial nationalist parties like the NPD in Germany. We're going to bring them around a roundtable once a month and talk about issues within the various countries as best they can. As you all are aware, our comrades in Germany are facing another attempt to ban them. So understand that some of our comrades in certain countries can't say everything that we're allowed to say. And for the most part, you know, you don't hear a lot of what our guest today refers to as goo-boo and space madness coming out of Europe, because they're doing real work. They're actually engaging in real political activity as opposed to shooting virtual spitballs on the internet at each other. And we'll get it to be another show that I'm not going to talk about. I'm not going to release the name yet, but I think it's going to be all very, very interesting. And I'm going to encourage you all to tune into my show next week and tune into our website. But we're going to have another United States-based show announced as well. But then also on March 29th, we are going to have a two-hour telethon, a fundraising telethon, to benefit Gary Yarborough, one of the Order POWs, his legal fund. As many of you know, he was supposed to be released after 30 years in Zog's Gulag, and they trumped up some reason to deny him his mandatory release. And they have been successful. His wife has been successful in raising funds to retain a lawyer, but there is still some funds that need to be raised. So ANN is going to host a two-hour telethon, which will include music, discussion, and participation by some luminaries within our movement to support Gary's efforts and Gary's wife's efforts to get him released after 30 years in the gulag. Now, that'll be a two-hour telethon on March 29th. We'll hear about that in one of our promos here in this show later on in the broadcast. But I want to encourage you all to visit our website at www.ana-ann.com. There's a lot of information there on our upcoming broadcasts, our upcoming shows, and events like the telethon that we're doing for our POWs. It's important that we support our POWs, that we don't just throw them away once they get shipped off to the gulag. No movement worth its weight does that, with the exception of the American white nationalist movement. But anyway, without any further ado, I want to bring on and welcome our guest, Harold Covington, the spokesman of the Northwest Front. He might be controversial, but he's engaging in real activism. He's implementing the Butler Plan in the Northwest Front. He talks about the character issue, which we talk about on ANN as well. He's written some outstanding novels, and we're going to talk about some of these issues on this broadcast. Harold, thanks for coming on Worldview Conversations this evening.
Glad to be here, Rodney.
And I think it's important to note that we simulcast, ANN Radio simulcast the radio show Radio Free Northwest every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern, and we're pleased to do that. So you can either listen to that broadcast via the Northwest Front's website, or you can tune in here at ANN Radio and listen to this simulcast at 6 p.m. Eastern on Thursday. But let's start off, and this is a question that I ask all the guests. Harold, give us a little bit of background. Who is Harold Covington, and what brought Harold Covington to our racialist cause?
Well, I was born in North Carolina, grew up there, and to make a long and, of course, complex story short, I got thrown into an integrated high school at the age of 14, just a little bit short of my 15th birthday, and I got 3 years up close and personal with the joys of integration, as it was called back then. Nowadays, we'd call it multiculturalism and diversity and that sort of mess. And as dramatic as this sounds, but it's true, on my last day there, just before my graduation, as I trudged up the hill to the parking lot to leave Chapel Hill High School for the last time, I sort of turned around and looked back at the place, and I made myself a promise that I was going to spend the rest of my life making sure that no other white kid, boy or girl, ever had to go through what I went through in that place. And I ended up getting hooked up when I was in the United States Army with the National Socialist White People's Party, which was George Lincoln Rockwell's American Nazi Party. They changed the name in 1967. And I became converted, if you will, to National Socialism, and I am still, in my personal outlook, a National Socialist. And it sort of went on from there. I have been involved in the movement in one way or another. Well, you can either date it from 1972, when I joined the NSWPP, or you can date it from 1968, when I walked into Chapel Hill High wearing a Wallace for President button. And in any case, it's now about 40 years that I have been involved in various white nationalist activities, groups, and so forth and so on. And I can't put my finger on the exact point when I said to myself, hey, you know, this stuff we're doing just isn't working. We're going to have a plan. The one thing I noticed very quickly about the white nationalist movement in America once I got involved in it was this perpetual sense of drift. No one seemed to know exactly what it was we were aiming for, what it was we were going to do, how we were going to do it, and it's just sort of, we were floating on the surface and kind of like a balloon, if you might use that analogy, just sort of drifting with the wind wherever it took us. And, of course, I had studied enough history to know that that's not the way you bring about revolutionary change. And it's always been clear to me that what we have in this country is actual revolutionary change from top to bottom. There must be a complete replacement of the existing power structure with our own. And, again, trying to cut this down to something that could fit inside an hour, I think it was probably Ruby Ridge that sort of turned the little light bulb on over my head, and I realized that in the martyrdom of the Weaver family, we had, in essence, the first blood being shed for a new nation. The idea of a Northwest Republic for white people, a homeland, is not unique to me. I did not invent it. I make no such claim, but that was the point where I kind of became convinced that was the way we should be going. For various reasons, I didn't immediately embrace this idea publicly, but the absolute catalyst was what happened to Pastor Butler in the year 2000. And so, being a writer, I decided that I was going to do two things in response to what was done to Pastor Butler by Morris Deese. I was going to personally migrate to the Northwest, make my home here, make my career here, and spend the rest of my life advocating the establishment of a white independent nation in the Pacific Northwest. And the second thing I was going to do was I was going to write a novel giving some of my ideas about how this might come about. That novel was eventually published because a charming little number called Print Per Order Publishing had come along by then through the internet, and it was now possible for me to publish more or less uncensored works. And I'm not the only one, by the way, who has made use of this facility. There is now a whole body of pro-white literature in existence from white authors using Print Per Order Publishing and internet publishing, so forth and so on. That first book was called The Hill of the Ravens. It turned out to be the first of five novels based on what has come to be called the Northwest Mythos, or Mythos. I did not intend for that to happen when I wrote the first book, but it just sort of developed a life of its own. I kept getting a lot of fan letters from people that would read each book as they came out, and they said, well, Harold, this is really great. I like your book so far, but you didn't address this, or you didn't address that. And so the end result of this is that over the past, really, well, 10, 11 years, I've published five Northwest novels, in addition, of course, to all my other books on various subjects. And the Northwest novels constitute a kind of, well, the way I like to put it is that you can't really put together a jigsaw puzzle unless you actually have the cover of the box that shows you the picture that you're trying to create. And in essence, the Northwest novels show our people the cover of the puzzle box. They show us the end product, what we're striving for. And the books themselves give some idea as to how that could be brought about. They do involve a IRA-style campaign here in the Northwest. I base a lot of that part of these books on the various things that I myself observed when I was living in Ireland for about 5 years in the 1980s. I wasn't just sitting there in the pub supping up the Guinness. I was actually paying attention to what was going on around me. In essence, in Ireland, I saw how it's done in the real world and in the modern time. But a lot of people say, well, Harold, you're inciting to violence and this sort of stuff. There's one thing, really, I think that you need to know about the Northwest novels, and then I'll shut up about it because I could talk about this for hours. But the purpose of the Northwest novels is not to tell young white people what they should do. The purpose of the Northwest novels is to show them who they should be. The most important thing about the Northwest novels is not the violence or the plot lines or the explosions and assassinations and all that good stuff. The most important thing about the Northwest novels is the characters themselves. The mostly young freedom fighters of the Northwest Volunteer Army, the NVA. In essence, what I do there is I describe the white character as it should be, not as it unfortunately is.
You touched on the white character issue, and I want to ask, I'm not going to get into naming names because it's not...
Okay, Roger, you want to break up really bad here.
Yeah. Okay, I hear you.
I kind of guess at what you're saying, but you go ahead. Like I say, you're kind of breaking up.
Earlier, you said that we need a revolutionary movement, and I want to compare and contrast that with the character question. Would you not agree that the vast majority of people who identify as white nationalists really don't get that, and it's a matter of convenience? That I still hear a lot of, we're going to take our country back, we're going to take Detroit back, we're going to take Chicago back, and to me, that is just utter fantasy. First of all, I don't want Detroit back, I don't want Chicago back. I don't want.
Yeah,
so how do you answer to somebody that gets on radio podcasts and finds, you know, that, you know, only cowards want to go off and create their own ethno state? I think they're foolish that they're going to get Detroit and Chicago and cities to where white populations are now down to the lower single digits percentiles, and to think we're going to get all that back. Why would we want it back to begin with, Harold?
Yeah, right.
And quite frankly, well, frankly, it's survival. You know, I would rather carve out my own ethno state. so my kids are going to have a future and I'm going to see grandkids, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. But how do you answer the fundamental question?
Well, when I started with the Northwest idea that I was advocating, I did get a lot of people, not so much anymore because events have kind of caught up with us, but at first I did get a lot of people telling me, well, we ain't moving nowhere. I'm going to stay right here in Hogwaller, Arkansas. My daddy was born here, my granddaddy was born here, and I'm going to stand and fight. Well, that's great. But the trouble is, no one is standing and fighting. Fighting does not consist of tapping on a computer keyboard. Now, we still do get some people, even in their approach to the Northwest, who have this idea that they are going to somehow be allowed to come here and take over some little small town in Idaho or Oregon and build a sort of a Beaver Cleaverville and bring back the 1950s, you know, the Bobby Sox and, you know, all that sort of stuff. It's a nice dream, and I can understand why people would like to do that. It'd be a real nice thing to do if it was possible, but it's not. No one is allowed to opt out of the system in this country. The powers that be understand that their system will only work, insofar as it works at all, which isn't very far, if everybody participates. It's interesting that South Africa has now become this terribly mismanaged black-run country, but the ANC government has sense enough to understand that they have to retain a certain few million whites as kind of technocratic pets in order to keep things running and keep a modern economy and a modern infrastructure running. And the same thing applies in this country. The people that rule the United States right now understand that they can't afford to let the white man go. And they can't afford to let the white man separate from the system. Now, as far as this idea that we are going to somehow take over this entire country and just, in essence, turn the clock back to the 1950s, I don't really know what to say, except that's not going to happen. The clock of history always runs forward. It never runs backwards. The demographic situation in this country is a disaster, and it's now gone. We have already lost America. The only way in which anything of that kind could be accomplished would be if we had a massive and loyal and totally, frankly, ruthless military force at our command to force all these somewhat 150 or so million undesirables of various kinds out of the country. And let's be realistic, that's just not going to happen. What's going to happen in this country is what is already happening. We have witnessed this process for many years now. It's going to be a Soviet-style breakup as the United States collapses into various power groupings, ethnic groupings, like the Mexicans and the Hispanics, for example, are quite open about their desire to create something called Aztlan in the Southwest. That's happening. It's not that they're going to do it. They are doing it. They're doing it through demographics. And eventually there will probably be some kind of Republic of New Africa in the South. There may be a liberal stand of some kind in New England. In what's called flyover country, it's going to be a real mess. You're probably going to end up with balkanized little enclaves of various racial and ethnic groupings there. I notice that every time they get a new influx of immigrants from Nigeria or Somalia or Laos or someplace, they always seem to stick them right in the middle of the white heartland of the Midwest in order to break up those solid ethnically white areas. 10 years ago, Iowa was still almost all white. Now they've got, you know, Somali gangs in Des Moines. It's just, it's horrible. They are presenting us with facts on the ground, and those facts on the ground aren't going to change. This country is going to break up. It is breaking up now. There is not a damn thing we can do about it. There will be no turning back the clock, and the only thing that we can do is make sure that when that happens, the white man gets a piece of the pie when the pie is divided up. We believe that the white man's piece of the pie needs to be here in the Pacific Northwest for a variety of demographic, economic, and spiritual reasons. But what we're talking about here, Rodney, is a process that is occurring even as we speak. It's not like we have any choice, and it is essential that the small fragment of the white race that is racially aware and that does have some idea that we are facing an existential crisis get our act together and we embrace the one movement in this country's entire political spectrum that has any chance of success, which is the Northwest Imperative. See, this is what makes the Northwest Front so different. We have the plan. We have an idea. We have everything from a new constitution in waiting. But we're the only people who have that with everybody else. You ask them, you know, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? And the answer, well, usually you don't get an answer, but their plan, insofar as I can detect any plan at all, is just to keep on tapping on the computers and making silly comments on one another's blogs. I just ain't going to cut it. We have the plan. No one else does. I mean, as arrogant as this may sound, the simple fact is we're right. And these other people are very, very badly mistaken, dangerously mistaken. Mistaken to the point where, in my opinion, a lot of this other stuff that's going on constitutes a threat to the continued existence of the white race, because it's just time for us to quit messing around and get on with it. This is it. This is showtime. No more practice swings, no more do-overs. We have one plan that is viable and that will work, and we damn well better start using it.
It's a matter, Harold, of being, you know, wanting to be caught behind enemy lines when this breakup happens. I agree with you. The United States is headed for a Soviet-style breakup. All the economic, social, and other indicators are there. It's just a matter of time and when. I think it would have happened much sooner had the government not engaged in some of the bailouts in 2008 and 2009. Mm-hmm. But we're almost at the halfway mark. We're going to take a short break, about 2 minutes. And when we come back, I want to talk to you about some of the dynamics in the Pacific Northwest. We'll be back in about 2 minutes. We're talking to Harold Levington, the spokesman of the Northwest Front, also known as the Butler Plan. And there is a tagline: if white people had a country of our own, none of this would be happening. We'll be back in about 2 minutes. And welcome back to this March 6, 2015 edition of Worldview Conversations. The guest is Harold Covington. Harold, it's a no-brainer. When you are encircled and surrounded, especially when if you're married, children, as I do, and circled and surrounded by hostiles, to get out and to go somewhere. Mm-hmm. Our ancestors did that. They, now you talked about in your broadcast of pioneers that, you know, your last broadcast, maybe the week before, you talked about the child that was found during the excavation or destruction,
yes,
I believe, of a tree stump. People buried
the children as
they were going to a better place. People fought hostile Indians to go to a better place, to make a new world. But yet, here we hear people, we see them on YouTube, we see them on blogs and forum talking about they're worried for their wives, they're worried for their children, but they stay, and yet there is an opportunity to begin building an ethnostate. And by the way, mm-hmm, I'll announce today, it's my intention to leave California and to help build that ethnostate as well. I mean, California is already, my people already a minority in California. There's no reason for me and my people to stay here. We're not going to retake California and have the days of California when it was the opening scenes of Dragnet, when L.A. was a beautiful white city. That's over. It's gone. I don't want it back. Nice memories, but it's gone forever. Mm-hmm. We're not going to get it back. And so it's my desire, and it's, you know, we're working, my wife and I are working to leave and to migrate north. And it's, you know, we're done. And that's for the survival of my children and for a future for my grandchildren. I mean, that's just it. We're bound up by hostiles. Now, it is nice and sexy to say on blogs and forums, and some, and for some, for fundraising purposes, we're going to go down fighting. Well,
okay, I'm losing you real bad there, Rodney.
All right, there we go. What do you say to those that say, well, the Pacific Northwest is loaded with liberals, and it's really no different there than any place else? Washington State legalized pot. Let's talk about some of the you know, what could be perceived as legitimate questions.
Okay.
Let's talk about the political dynamics. What do you say to people saying that it's just as hostile politically?
Okay. I'm losing you again. I'll tell you what, I'm just going to start talking. I'm just going to start addressing that. Yeah, Oregon and Washington have a reputation for being excessively liberal, although I might add that the two of the other states in the homeland, Idaho and Montana, are the exact opposite. But what you have to understand about Washington and Oregon and their so-called liberal Democrat reputation is that we're talking about the I-5 corridor there. Specifically, we are talking about two huge urban areas Portland and Seattle. The relationship between Portland and the rest of Oregon and Seattle and the rest of Washington is roughly similar to that between upstate New York and New York City. These two huge urban areas completely dominate these states politically. Almost all of the two states' non-white population is concentrated in the Pugetopolis and Portland area. Right now, one of the communities we are building, the one I live in here, is in the Puget area. We do have to sort of bring new migrants to some of these areas because of the job situation. But that's a whole other story. Seattle and Portland just completely dominate and outvote the rest of the state. And that's why you get all these liberal Democrats, including the governor of Oregon, who was just thrown out of office for a typical bit of corruption there. He was basically siphoning off state funds to give to his live-in girlfriend, who was living with him in the governor's mansion, and good, you know, little scandals like that. Don't be fooled by the fact that the state governments in Washington and Oregon are dominated by liberal Democrats. That's Seattle and Portland talking, and a few other areas. There is a large liberal enclave in Eugene, Oregon, because of the university there. There is a fairly large liberal enclave in Spokane, again, because of some of the more higher-end economic things there that have drawn various liberals and blue state types. And I might add that Spokane is a good example. The liberals seem to have targeted Spokane for almost a generation and deliberately built up their power and whatnot in Spokane through altering the demographics through migration, which is what we're trying to do. Contrary-wise, across in the Idaho panhandle, right now it's kind of almost axiomatic in Idaho. It's impossible to get a Democrat elected because of all the various people that have fled Idaho who are of a conservative bent, such as Mark Furman, the former LA cop, etc. And I think a lot of that, frankly, has something to do with Pastor Butler's presence in northern Idaho, which gave the state a reputation as white-friendly. But once you get out of those two cities, you get out of Portland and the greater Portland area, and bear in mind, these are huge urban areas, and once you get out of the Seattle area, you get into the rural parts of Washington and Oregon, you will find that the population is 97% white. You will find that the population is very conservative and very normal. And we do get migrants. And by the way, our own migration is progressing. We, in fact, welcomed two new residents to Oregon just last week. One of them was a young man of 18 who literally worked his way up from California. And the other was a gentleman from Texas who just said, I've had enough. And he got on his motorcycle and he hit the road and he came home. Our own migration is working, and some of these people that we're bringing in do come here to the Puget area or to their larger urban areas because they need the work and because they need the economic activity that goes with these areas. But others go out into these small towns in eastern Oregon or Idaho on the high plains there or some little town in western Washington. We had a young couple move to Aberdeen, of all places, fairly recently, and they find that this, in essence, In these areas of the Northwest that are outside these two huge metropolitan areas, it's kind of like the last little slice of the old America. You can actually go out and have breakfast at a mom-and-pop diner that'll make you a nice ordinary omelet with hash browns. It's not, you know, Chinese restaurants and chain pizza stores and all that stuff. It's hard to describe until you're there. We get people coming here not just to migrate, but on their scouting trips to check the place out. And almost invariably, when I meet them, the first thing they say to me is they say, my God, look at all the white people. I actually went into a Burger King today and there was white people working behind the counter. It's incredible. The demographics in the Northwest is deteriorating like they are everywhere else. But again, we're talking largely in the urban areas. Non-white minorities tend to gravitate to these urban areas. They could teach us a thing or two about building communities because they automatically gravitate to where there are people of their own race and their own whatnot. And so all of those are in the large cities. And like I say, and really there's only two of those in the Northwest, Portland and Seattle. There are a few more, like I say, urbanized areas which are fairly middle-sized, Spokane, Eugene, Bend, although Bend, I understand, we've got a fair number of new migrants heading for Bend, Oregon, and they swear by it. They say it's just one of the nicest places they've ever been. Down around Medford and Ashland in Oregon, I've had people tell me it's kind of like California used to be 30, 40 years ago because of climate change or whatever. They've actually got wine growing down there, and it's just this idea that this is some sort of liberal citadel is, well, there is some truth to it because of these state governments that are elected by Seattle and Portland, but there's a lot more to it than meets the eye, put it that way.
Well, I can tell you, I've lived in Washington State three times when I was very, very young, when my, you know, because I had a parent that was in the Army at Fort Lewis, and then during my own tenure at Fort Lewis, and then for a period of time a few years ago when I was doing working on a contract project. And I can tell you that, you know, my wife and I really like Lacey, Washington, and that's the area that we have picked, actually, to get to go back to is Lacey, Washington.
I used to live in Lacey for about 2 years.
So that's our objective, is Lacey, Washington. I actually have friends from the Army stayed after they got out. Now it's Joint Base Lewis-McChord, and so I have friends up there. But you're right. You see white people that are doing the jobs that we're told that white people won't do, but they're doing the jobs in the Pacific Northwest, aren't they, Harold?
Well, exactly. Well, there's something else that people need to know when they're considering migrating to the Northwest. Like I say, we are actually succeeding in getting a small migration going here. A lot of people come to our own area here in the Puget Sound area. They go elsewhere in the Northwest. I have never known a migrant who come, and some of them just rock up here with no job. I have never known a migrant who went without employment of some kind for more than 3 or 4 weeks. There are jobs available here. This is one of the few places in the country where you can still go out on the street and, like, you know, right up from where I'm living now, there's a plant of some kind. I'm not even sure what they do, but they've got a now hiring sign. The economy here is still viable. If you actually want to work, you can get a job. It might not be maybe as good as what you had in Chicago or whatever, but it's something that will tide you over until you can settle in here. And this is what we ask people to do. Now, let me explain something. Now, my works are fiction. There is no NVA here. There is no great violent revolution going on, nothing of the kind. Just as the colonists from a century and a half, they lived in America before they actually revolted against King George. It's the same thing. The first colonists landed at Jamestown and Plymouth Rock, but rather than immediately start thinking of revolting against the king and creating the United States or anything like that, they had to build their cabins, they had to plant their crops, they had to build their schools, churches, they had to build their economy, they had to build their way of life, they had to marry and have children, etc. We are not asking people to come here and participate in some big, violent IRA-style revolution, despite the impression you may get from my novels. We are asking people to come here and settle and build their lives here, sink their roots into this part of the world, so that when the time does come to raise the green, white, and blue, we will have communities in place and we will have a base. We are kind of trying to do, on a somewhat smaller scale, what the Mexicans have done. We are attempting to deliberately alter the demographics of a given area. And because we have selected this part of the world, which is smaller than, say, the whole continent, that's possible. You have to understand that a large part of the Butler Plan means reducing the problem to manageable proportions. Once you get into the homeland, we're dealing with a population of, practically speaking, something on the order of about 20 million people as opposed to 320 million people in the whole country. We're dealing with distances that are, for the most part, drivable in a single day. When you want to get together with somebody or when the time comes to begin having overt political activities, we can manage it in this smaller area by concentrating our forces, so to speak. And I'm familiar with this idea, well, we can't all concentrate in one place because they'll bomb us or they'll wipe us out, blah, blah, blah. That really, when you think about it, doesn't make any sense. Every persecuted minority in history that has survived, notably, say, the Jews, have always survived by banding together and by living among their own as much as they could and by, in essence, building, I suppose you might call, fortifications against the outside world, both cultural and economic. For example, in the Middle Ages, the Jews rant and rave and scream about the ghettos in European cities. The ghettos were not, in most cases, established by the Christian authorities or by the local king or baron or anything. The ghettos were set up by the Jews themselves to keep their own people from wandering and straying from the old ways, etc., etc. The ghettos were a survival mechanism that the Jews themselves established. Possibly that's a bad analogy. There's another bad analogy that I don't really like, but it's, I think, a little bit germane. What we're trying to do here is what the Jews did in Israel. Now, it took the Jews 50 years from the time of the first Zionist Congress in 1898 until 1948, when Israel basically made their land grab and chased out all the Arabs and became a nation. It took them 50 years to do it. I hope it won't take us quite as long to do that here, because we just don't have the time and we're under physical and genocidal assault. But this is going to be an ongoing process for a long time. It is a major undertaking, possibly the biggest undertaking our people have ever engaged in, because it means our racial survival. And we really have to put aside all of these little belly aches and all of these little yes buts and all these little but what ifs and that sort of stuff. Frankly, a lot of this stuff is just an excuse for the fact that we as a people have become weak and timid and frightened, and we're just scared to do anything. Migration to the Northwest requires courage. It's legal. There is not as yet an internal passport system in this country like they had in the old Soviet Union, although that's coming. But you see, you can do it. It is beneficial to you in the long run, and yet our people are just, majority of them, simply too frightened to do it. That's us, the white nationalists. We also have a phenomenon up here which I think may be what really saves us in the long end. We call it organic migration. That is, there are a lot of people, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of white people who are coming here to the Pacific Northwest, not because Northwest Front asked them to, they probably don't even know we exist, but they are coming here for racial reasons, although of course they'd never say so. If you ask a lot of these people who come here from various other parts of the country, well, why did you move here to the Northwest? They'd say, well, all the usual buzzwords, good schools and good economy and clean
and
air.
What that means is schools without niggers.
Exactly. Oh, good. I can say the N-word on here. I wasn't sure.
Nigger.
Okay.
It's like, that's right. But, remember him. As soon as they turn the
Jesse
mic on.
Jesse B. Stoner.
That's right.
I really wish I could find a tape of that very famous incident, but
yeah.
I know this isn't quite maybe germane to the Northwest, but
I'll tell you, you know what my answer to that N-word is, Harold, is when the niggers stop using it, I'll stop using it.
People ask me why I use words like nigger and kike and beaner and whatnot on my own podcast, and they say, well, Harold, you're alienating people, you're frightening people away, you can't do that. And I've given this spritz before, but basically it's Orwellian thought control. If you ever read my favorite novel of all time, 1984, the first thing you need to look at is the appendix on Newspeak, and Orwell speaks about the use of language to control thought. And this is what, in essence, the liberals or progressives or the power structure has done for over a generation now. They are attempting to control our thoughts by punishing the use of certain words to the point where we self-censor ourselves in our own mind. Because let's face it, if you're in the workplace or in a social situation or in public and you absentmindedly let slip a nigger or a kike or a faggot or something like that, in many cases your life is over, like that poor woman who made a politically incorrect tweet when she got on a plane for Cape Town, and by the time she landed in Cape Town, she had no job and she was being demonized and cyber-lynched. We see this, you know, now, especially with Twitter and the social media. They're trying to control the expression of, and they're trying to suppress certain words because they want to suppress the ideas. They want white people to self-censor themselves, and of course, the best way to make sure that you never accidentally let slip with a politically incorrect word that could destroy your life is to make sure you don't even think it. And it's a form of, frankly, terrorism and intimidation. But I use those words because we can't allow the liberal left to control the parameters of acceptable discussions. For far too long, we have allowed the enemy to decide what is acceptable and what is not. We have to take that back from them.
Well, Harold, build on that. I take it a step further, and I talk about the enemy and the gates. We have enemies in our own gates, like, dare say, I'm going to use a name here, Amren, who has conferences that says that people like you and I are extremists, and when you go to their conferences, you trip over a Jew and fall into the lap of a faggot, and that's movement moderation.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, we can't have that either.
Movement modernization, yeah. Well, don't get me off on movement modernization, because that's one of my sore points. I'm not going to name names. I have a kind of a bad reputation for doing that. For many, many years in the movement, I was the little child who said that the emperor had no clothes. But, you know, my view is this. If we're going to allow Jews and faggots among us, which seems to be the main point of movement modernization, and you know, not just as members but of our groups and our movements, but as leaders, like that ghastly Pim Fortuyn in flippin' Holland. If we're going to allow Jews and faggots and God knows what else in among our ranks, you know, what's the point of it all? Why are we doing any of it? One of the main aspects of movement modernization is, and I know this is different for our comrades in Europe, and I'm aware that the European situation is very different, but one of the main aspects of movement modernization is constant harping on Muslim, 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 and it tends to let the Jews off the hook. I have read so-called modernizing tracts on the internet where supposed white nationalists say, well, we must allow the Jews to stand with us against the Muslim threat because they are part of the European tradition. Yeah, they are a bad part. If you're going to allow Jews, homos, degeneracy, quasi-Marxism, I mean, what is the point? The object is to save our race from extinction. How can we do that when we allow the very tendencies and the very poisons that liberal democracy is using to destroy us in our, into our own ranks? It's insane. It's... ugh.
Well, that's it.
I think you're
absolutely correct, Harold, and I think we need to have a very high level of standards and separate ourselves from the cancer. I mean, you don't choose brain cancer in favor of pancreatic cancer. Both are deadly, and, you know, Jews are a cancer. They've been a cancer on white Western civilization for all time. But we have about 5 minutes left, Harold, and what I want to give that last 5 minutes to you to talk about what's in the immediate future for the Northwest Front. Then I also want to give time to tell the listeners what's the best method for contacting the Northwest Front if they want to migrate.
I'll go ahead and I'll get that last part first. Our website is northwestfront.org. That's all one word, northwestfront.org. And the first step, obviously, is to go to that website, check out what we've got. You'll find some stuff about the Northwest Novels on there. You'll find things like a copy of the proposed Constitution for the Northwest Republic, which is interesting of itself. That Constitution was put together by a committee which included men like the late David Lane, some of the Order Men, and various other people who I won't name now, but it was a group effort. It's not just something I sat down and scribbled out one night. My personal email is nwnet@earthlink.net. That's N-W-N-E-T @earthlink.net. Drop me a line. You will get a thing back from my spam block. You can contact me. You can contact, well, depending on how things develop, we can put you into contact with local people in the area where you want to go. But the next step, and this is not just an author trying to peddle books, you really need to get hold of and read some of the Northwest Novels. I would suggest that you actually start with number 4 in the series, The Brigade, which is probably the book that I will be remembered for insofar as I'm remembered at all. Now, as far as what's next for the Northwest Front, well, our main effort, and it's going to be like this for the future, for the foreseeable future, we are trying to build communities here. We actually have several small core groups in various places around the Northwest, the homeland, here in the Pugetopolis, of course. It looks like we're getting a fair number of people coming to Oregon. They're kind of scattered at the moment, and we have a few active people in Portland, but we are trying to build communities here. The object is to bring white people into existing white nationalist communities where there is a support system and where you have white nationalist comrades of a high caliber, you know, people who are functional in society, and you have these people living within half an hour's drive of one another. It's somewhat similar to the so-called Pioneer Little Europe thing. There are some other community style things going on out in Idaho, etc., etc. But the main thing that we're pushing right now is we need people to come here. The Northwest Front is unique. Every other group you join, if insofar as there are any actual groups left besides the internet, and that's not very far, but every other group you join because of something you say. The Northwest, you join through something you do. Your membership number is your zip code.
And
the Northwest
is it not important,
is
Harold?
Deed-based.
Is it important, Harold, that people contact you with with their name and with a actual address as opposed to a pseudonym and an email address?
Well, part of our contact process, the first thing we want to do is we want to get you an introductory packet of literature, which will contain copies of the Northwest Observer, leaflets, a couple of CDs of Radio Free Northwest, And also it will contain a copy of what we call the White Book, which is our party manual. That is the first step in getting active with the NF. We need to get you that packet, so we will need a name and address of some kind where the post office will deliver mail. We understand that some people are a little bit leery about coming to a group like ours and immediately giving all their personal information. If it proceeds, we will want to check you out before we get too involved with somebody. We want to know who the hell we're talking to, because with the Internet, you never know. That's one of the most dangerous things about the Internet. You never really know who you're talking to. I've been punked a few times on the net, not extensively, because I've gotten pretty good at detecting it. But, I mean, we don't want to spend a lot of time on an Internet contact and then have it turn out to be the holy rabbi, Hyman Hebelbaum from Temple Schmuckel, who's doing it for the ADL. To some degree, our philosophy is, if you don't trust us, then we don't trust you. But that's necessary. We are trying to build a revolutionary movement here, even if not necessarily a violent one. And well, as part of that, we need to know who the hell we're talking to.
We have to leave it there, Harold. We're out of time. Thanks for joining us, Harold.
Okay.
And listeners, have a great weekend. Visit the Northwest Front's website.
Okay.
Have a great weekend.
This has been Worldview Conversations.